طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح. طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media, which is why it is so important that we broadcast that voice each and every week. Israel continues to be obsessed by the success of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. Israel is trying to legislate against it at both the state and federal level, and is now attempting to prevent its proponents from entering Israel, which includes the Palestinian territories. The following account is from Mondo Weiss. The Israeli government has published its BDS blacklist, which would prevent entry to Israel, known for months to be in the works. It includes 20 organizations that support the Palestinian-led nonviolent boycott, divestment, and sanctions, BDS, resistance movement against the occupation, including U.S.-based organizations American Muslims for Palestine, Code Pink, the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, and Jewish Voice for Peace. Strategic Affairs Minister Gilad Erdan, who played a critical role in compiling the blacklist, touted it as a strategic change in the way Israel handles BDS. "We have shifted from defense to offense," Erdan said. "The boycott organizations need to know that the State of Israel will act against them and not allow them to enter its territory to harm its citizens." The other blacklisted U.S. organizations are National Students for Justice in Palestine and the American Friends Service Committee, as well as 11 European organizations and three more based in South Africa and South America. Leaders and members of the blacklisted organizations view it as an official implementation of Israel's long-followed unofficial policy of turning away Palestinian human rights activists at its border. Omar Barghouti, a founder of the BDS movement, said in a press release that Israel's new McCarthyism is reaching a new low. By waging an all-out war on the peaceful BDS movement for Palestine rights, and by now banning international human rights organizations and advocates from entry, Israel's desperate and brutal attempts to weaken support for BDS are already backfiring. In an interview with Plus 972 magazine, Jewish Voice for Peace Executive Director Rebecca Vilcomerson noted that Israel's decision to specifically ban JVP leaders from entry is disconcerting but not surprising, given the consistent erosion of democratic norms as well as increasing fear of the BDS movement in Israel. To Vilcomerson, the blacklist is not only an organizational hardship, but a personal one. The Brooklyn activist is married to an Israeli and has extensive family and friends in Israel and the West Bank, whom she will likely no longer be able to visit. But the barring of Jewish Voice for Peace, an explicitly Jewish organization, suggests a true ideological contradiction forming between Israel's claim as a homeland for all Jews and Israel's fear of the catalyzing BDS movement. And it further reveals the fissures within the mainstream American Jewish communities regarding Israel. Among the 20 blacklisted organizations, there was an overwhelming sense of momentum, an affirmation that BDS is successfully putting pressure on Israel to end its abuse of Palestinians. This blacklist is a declaration of failure and defeat by the State of Israel as it grows out of the global BDS movement. Dr. Osama Abu Irshad, National Policy Director at American Muslims for Palestine, told Mondawise, "Israel failed in confronting this movement, which is a non-violent movement for Palestinian rights, and the only way for Israel to deal with this is to repress the activists who are fighting for Palestinian rights in a non-violent way, as it represses the Palestinians in a violent way within the borders of occupied Palestine," Abu Irshad added. It is unclear exactly how or if the ban will inhibit the work of the blacklisted organizations, many of which already work primarily inside the United States. But Ariel Gold of Code Pink noted that the BDS blacklist could have the effect of keeping those of us that work really hard for Palestinian rights as disconnected as possible to the people struggling on the ground. The blacklist would almost certainly prevent Gold and other members of Code Pink, an organization particularly active in protests alongside Palestinians in places such as Nabi Saleh or Hebron in the occupied West Bank, from entry into Israel. It will keep us from being able to see with our own eyes and keep us from being able to participate with our own bodies, Gold told Mondawise. But Gold recognized the absurdity and desperation in this move and is confident many others will as well. She explained to me that as a Jew, it is fair for her to challenge everything, even the very concept of God. But to Israel, the only thing immune to challenge is the validity of a Jewish state. Israel is willing to do anything, even give up their image, which was already a false image, of being a democratic state and being a homeland for all Jews, in order to try and prevent the inevitable, Gold said. This BDS ban really only strengthens the movement further. It allows the rest of the world to see the hypocrisy that Israel is even more clearly. At the news that the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights was included in the blacklist, Executive Director Youssef Munayer wrote the following in a defiant letter to supporters. "We wear this designation as a badge of honor. When Israel, which aims to portray itself to the world as liberal and democratic, blacklists activists dedicated to nonviolent organizing and dissent, it only further exposes itself as a fraud. It is clear to us how effective building the movement for Palestinian rights around the world has become. Our commitment to the rights of Palestinians and our demand to hold Israel account for the denial of these rights is unwavering. As in the effort against apartheid in South Africa, the blacklist and repressive efforts like it will be mere footnotes in the historic march toward freedom, justice, and equality." Okay, that was an article from the Mondawise News Service. And BDS marches on. Our feature presentation this week is a recent speech delivered at the United Nations by Columbia University professor Rashid Khalidi on the impact of the Balfour Declaration on the Palestinian people. It is presented to a UN committee to advance the rights of the Palestinian people. We are including the entire introduction of the speech by its committee chair, Jerry, from South Africa.
A very good afternoon to you all. It's a pleasure to be here with you. My name is Jerry from South Africa. Today I represent, and I've been asked by the United Nations Committee on the Exercise of the Annual Rights of Palestinian People to take care of the proceedings. I have an honor of welcoming you to today's lecture by Professor Rashid Khalidi on the impact of the Balfour Declaration has had on the Palestinian people. Today's lecture will be broadcast live, so you have to smile all the time. When I say this, you smile. And simultaneously, interpretation will be provided to the extent possible in English and Arabic. Our committee is a subsidiary body of the United Nations General Assembly with a mandate to advance and advocate for the rights of Palestinian people, including their right to self-determination in accordance with international law and the principles of the Charter of the United Nations. Our committee is comprised of 50 member states from all the regions of the world and plays a critical role in mobilizing international support for a peaceful settlement of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. Ladies and gentlemen, as we know, 2017 marked the 50th year of the Israeli occupation, which began in 1967, and the 70th anniversary of the United Nations resolution to partition Palestine. But it also marks the centenary of the Balfour Declaration. 100 years ago, today, through the darkest days of World War I, the government of the United Kingdom announced its support for the establishment of a Jewish national home in Palestine. A letter sent from the UK Foreign Secretary Alfred Balfour to one of the British most distinguished Jewish citizens and Zionist at the time, Baron Rothschild, changed the course of history of the region forever until now. While Israel has been established according to that partition as a national home for the Jewish people, Palestinians remains in limbo, without a sovereign state of their own, and with the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem, a small fraction of what constituted Palestine in 1947. Under the continued Israeli occupation, and in view of all of us, including the United Nations, some will argue that the Balfour Declaration was harbinger for future injustices, conflict, and more unfulfilled promises, such as the 1947 partition plan and Oslo agreements and all other subsequent agreements. Today's lecture gives us an opportunity to hear about the profound impact of this declaration has had on Palestinian people from a renowned scholar in the modern Middle East and a member of a prominent Jerusalem family whose representatives have distinguished themselves in the whole walks of life of Palestinian life. Professor Khalidi is an eminent scholar whose research primarily covers the history of the modern Middle East, with a particular focus on ways in which external powers have shaped development and conflict in that area. In his book, I quote, "Palestinian Identity, the Construction of Modern National Consciousness," published in 1997, one of his signature works, Professor Khalidi argues that Arabs living in Palestine began to regard themselves as a distinct people decades before 1948 partition, and the Nakba, or the catastrophe ending in the flight or expulsion of 50% of Arab populations in Palestine from their homes and from their lands. His scholarship provides a cogent rejoinder to Israel's nationalistic narrative that Arabs in Palestine had no collective identity prior to the 1945's creation of Israel. Professor Khalidi has published widely and won numerous awards, including a top honor of the Middle East Studies Association of North America, the Alpha Haruri Book Award for writing the best book in 1997. In addition to teaching and writing, Professor Khalidi was an advisor to Palestinian negotiations team in the early 1990s. Professor Khalidi is a uniquely positioned to address today's subject. It is a privilege to have you here today, sir. Thank you for taking time at your busy and hectic schedule to deliver today's lecture. We really appreciate it. Now, it's my honor on your behalf to invite Professor Khalidi to deliver his lecture. Afterwards, he will take some few questions. You have the floor, sir.
Thank you very much. Thank you all for coming, and thank you, Your Excellency, for that generous introduction. It's a great honor to be asked to speak here at the United Nations on the 100th anniversary of the Balfour Declaration. I'm grateful to His Excellency Ambassador Fodé-Sek of Senegal, to Ambassador Jerry of South Africa, our chair today, to the entire Committee on the Exercise of the Inalienable Rights of the Palestinian People, and to the dedicated staff of the UN Secretariat for making this event possible. I think it's particularly fitting to be speaking today at the United Nations, which has played such a large role in the tragedy of Palestine. Today, I am going to take you on a short historical journey in which I will address the impact on the Palestinian people of the Balfour Declaration and of the League of Nations mandate that was based on that declaration. I can only hope that if we can all become more aware of this historical background, we, the world community, and the United Nations in particular, may be able to address the harm that was caused by this declaration to the Palestinians and by all that followed in a more fair and a more effective fashion than it has done over the past 70 years. Now, the momentous statement made on behalf of the British Cabinet on November 2, 1917, by Arthur James Balfour, who was His Majesty's Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs, is usually looked at in terms of British imperial interests, or in terms of its ostensible subject, a, quote, national home for the Jewish people. We know a great deal about Britain's commitment to Zionism. We know less about what the support of the British Empire via this declaration meant for the aims of Zionism and the Zionist movement, which for nearly half a century proudly described itself as a colonial endeavor, and which at the same time was a national movement in the making. The ultimate objective of political Zionism, as it was laid out by its founder, Theodor Herzl, in his 1896 booklet, Der Judenstaat, was as far-reaching as it was crystal clear. And these aims were never really deviated from. These aims were establishment of a Jewish state in Palestine. That's what the title of the book says, meaning, again, the book stresses this, Jewish sovereignty and control of immigration into the country. Whatever Britain may have intended by the Balfour Declaration, complete and exclusive control over the entirety of Palestine was what the Zionist movement consistently fought for during the ensuing half century and eventually obtained. It did so largely as a result of over two decades of unstinting British support secured via this declaration and via the League of Nations mandate that was based upon the declaration. Now, much of this is well known. However, what I want to talk about today is another aspect of this declaration that is of paramount, that I think is of paramount importance, and that is often ignored. This was the perspective of the people of Palestine, whose future the Balfour Declaration ultimately decided. For the Palestinians, this declaration, this statement, was a gun pointed directly at their heads, particularly in view of the colonialist ambiance of the early 20th century. As I will try to show this afternoon, the Balfour Declaration, in effect, constituted a declaration of war by the British Empire on the indigenous population of the land it was promising to the Jewish people as a national home. This declaration launched what has become a century-long assault on the Palestinian people aimed at implanting and fostering this national home at their expense. Now, some people have argued that Zionism can only be seen as a national movement. Others have argued it's a colonial settler movement. I would argue that one can walk and chew gum at the same time, and that from its inception, Zionism was both a nascent national movement and a colonial enterprise in search of a metropolitan sponsor. After having failed to find that sponsor elsewhere, Chaim Weizmann, the second leader of the Zionist movement after Theodor Herzl, succeeded with the wartime British cabinet. The Zionist movement thereafter had the support of the greatest power of the age, Great Britain, which was about to become one of the victors in World War I. Now, Zionism had been viewed with concern in Palestine as early as the late 19th century. But the Balfour Declaration, when it was finally revealed to Palestinians, meant that their country was now threatened by a far greater danger than they had earlier suspected. Indeed, at the very moment that the Balfour Declaration was issued, British troops were advancing northward through Palestine in pursuit of the retreating Ottoman army, and only 5 weeks after the declaration was issued, British forces entered Jerusalem, December 9th, 1917. The text of the declaration confirmed the nature of this danger. It consisted of a single paragraph of 67 words. I'm going to impose on your patience by reading it to you. 67 words. His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people, and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. That is the entirety of the Balfour Declaration issued, as we've just heard, to Lord Rothschild, the leader of the Zionist movement. Now, Palestine was an inhabited country in 1917. 94% of its population was Arab. This overwhelming Arab majority in the country that was the object of the Balfour Declaration went unmentioned by his lordship, except in a backhanded way, as the, quote, existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine. They were not described as a people. The words Palestinian and Arab do not appear in the text of the declaration. For all intents and purposes, as a national entity, for Lord Balfour, for the British cabinet, they did not exist. They were existing non-Jewish communities and no more. Furthermore, this is extremely important. They were offered only, quote, civil and religious rights. They were not offered political rights. They were not offered national rights. They were not offered representation. They were not described as a people. They were not told that they would have a national home. All of those things applied to the Jewish people, but not to the indigenous majority in Palestine. By way of contrast, Lord Balfour ascribed national rights to the Jewish people, who in 1917 were represented in Palestine by about 6% of the total population. Regarded in this way, Britain's backing for Herzl's aims of Jewish statehood, sovereignty, and control over immigration into Palestine had portentous implications. It meant British support for bringing into Palestine and implanting a foreign majority at the expense of the indigenous population's rights, and ultimately at the expense of its existence as a people in its own land. The Balfour Declaration thus meant that the Palestinians faced the prospect of being outnumbered by unlimited immigration and of losing control of their country to the Zionist drive for sole sovereignty over a country that was then almost completely Arab in population and culture. It took over 3 decades, and the mass expulsion of a little over half of the Arab population of Palestine from their homes in 1948 for these things to happen, but happen they did. Now, I've mentioned that even before World War I, there had been trepidation among the Arabs of Palestine about the rapid progress of the Zionist movement. This became a widespread sentiment as the movement grew in strength and as immigration to Palestine increased. Between 1909 and 1914, the two leading Haifa and Yaffa newspapers, Al-Karmel and Philistine, published over 200 articles warning about the danger of Zionism for the Palestinians. Scores of articles per year in each newspaper. Among the peasantry in areas of intensive colonization, Zionist inroads were felt in concrete terms as land purchase led to the removal of Arab peasants working on the land. Their concerns were shared by Arab city dwellers who observed with mounting concern the constant arrival of new European Jewish immigrants. This was before the war. Once the war had taken place, news of the Balfour Declaration reached Palestine only with much delay after November 2nd. All local newspapers had been closed since the beginning of the war. There were no papers in Palestine. Then, after British troops occupied the country, strict military occupation regime banned news of the declaration from being spread. The British did not want the population to know what they had pledged in the Balfour Declaration. They did not allow newspapers to open for 2 years after 1917. In fact, it was not until 1920 the first Palestinian papers were allowed to reopen. There were other reasons, however, for the delayed Palestinian reaction to the Balfour Declaration. These relate to the extraordinary wartime conditions that prevailed in Palestine and that caused intense suffering. The country had been the scene of more than a year of intense battles between British and Ottoman forces, which continued until 1918, such that by the end of the war, Palestinians were already prostrated and exhausted by severe wartime shortages, famine, penury, dislocation, the requisitioning of draft animals, and the conscription of almost every able-bodied man into the Ottoman army. Of all the major combatant powers, the Ottoman Empire suffered the heaviest wartime death toll. Britain, France, Germany suffered around 4% casualties in their adult male population. The Ottoman death toll was over 3 million dead, or 15% of the total population. Most of these people were civilians. In Greater Syria, including Palestine, there were 500,000 deaths due to famine alone between 1915 and 1918. Civilian deaths were compounded by horrific wartime casualties. 750,000 Ottoman soldiers out of the 2.8 million who had been mobilized died during the war. 1 in 4 soldiers died in Ottoman service. The impact of all of these factors on Palestine was intense. It's estimated that after growing over 1% annually in all of the pre-war years, the population of Palestine declined by 6% during World War I. It was against this grim background of mass suffering and the advance of British troops that Palestinians eventually learned about the issuance of the Balfour Declaration. The British tried to prevent them from learning about it, but they did learn about it. The shock of hearing about this promise to the Zionist movement by Lord Balfour was exacerbated by a British occupation that marked the end of 400 years of Ottoman sovereignty, a regime which had prevailed for a full 20 generations, almost twice the lifetime of the American Republic. There was nevertheless a rapid evolution in the way that Palestinians saw themselves during and after World War I. In a world where nationalism had been gaining ground for decades, a world war that had been driven by unrestrained nationalist sentiment provided a major boost to the national idea in Palestine and in other areas of the world. The enhanced salience of nationalism was compounded by the espousal in 1917 by both Woodrow Wilson and Vladimir Lenin of the principle of national self-determination. The endorsement of the national principle by two ostensibly anti-colonial powers had an enormous impact on peoples the world over. As a result of the hopes aroused and then disappointed by Wilson's 14 points, by the Bolshevik Revolution, by the Paris Peace Conference, there were massive anti-colonial upheavals in India, in Korea, in Egypt, and in many other countries. Now, I would argue that as a result of World War I and what followed, the Palestinians were suffering from what might be described as collective post-traumatic stress syndrome. And in a situation like this, they had to face entirely new realities as they entered a new post-war world suffused by nationalist fervor. The Ottoman Empire was now gone. It was replaced by the hegemony of the British and French empires, which in 1915 and 1916 had secretly carried out a self-interested colonial partition of the region, which we know as the Sykes-Picot Accords, that was publicly revealed only in 1917. Against this could be set the possibilities of Arab independence and self-determination, which had been promised secretly by Britain to Sharif Hussein of Mecca in 1916, and which was the subject of repeated British public pledges thereafter. Now, listen closely, because while these British promises were at best partially and belatedly kept, as regards other Arab peoples, they were never honored where the Arab population of Palestine was concerned. So while other Middle Eastern countries eventually achieved a measure of independence in the interwar period, no such option was on offer for the Palestinians. In Palestine, Great Britain operated with an entirely different set of rules than in other League of Nations mandates. Unlike all other Class A mandates, so-called, which had been established in the former Arab provinces of the Ottoman Empire, all of which were treated in accordance with Article 22 of the Covenant of the League of Nations as provisionally independent nations, Palestine and Palestine alone was denied such treatment. Instead, Palestine and the Palestinians faced a set of rules rigidly dictated by the terms of the Balfour Declaration, and the declaration, as we know, had been tailored to suit the desiderata of Zionism, a European colonizing project and a national movement which had now acquired as its patron a formidable army, a formidable empire whose armies were just then in the process of conquering Palestine. British troops were not to leave the country for over 30 years, by which time the Zionist enterprise had become firmly entrenched. As soon as they were able to do so, in the wake of World War I, the Palestinians began to challenge vigorously both the form of governance imposed by the British, based on the Balfour Declaration, and the introduction of the Zionist movement as a privileged interlocutor of the British. They did so initially in the shadow of a strict British military occupation regime that lasted until 1920 and was followed by a rule by a series of British high commissioners. The first of these high commissioners was Sir Herbert Samuel, a former cabinet minister and dedicated Zionist who laid the governmental foundations for much of what followed. In understanding the unsuccessful efforts of the Palestinians to oppose this regime, two crucial factors are of paramount importance. The first factor is that unlike most other peoples who fell under the sway of colonial rule, the Palestinians had to contend not only with the colonial power in the metropole, but also with the terms of the Balfour Declaration. They thus had to deal with a colonial settler movement, which, while it was beholden to Britain, was independent of Britain, and which had a powerful national impulse and an international base. Most importantly, they had a base in this country, in the United States. The second factor is that Britain did not rule Palestine outright as a colonial possession. It ruled Palestine as a mandatory power of the League of Nations. In rejecting Palestinian protests about the Balfour Declaration, British officials could simply point to the international legitimacy for its terms that was provided by the 1922 League of Nations mandate for Palestine, which, at the instigation of the British themselves, had incorporated verbatim the text of the Balfour Declaration. The Balfour Declaration constitutes the introduction to the League of Nations mandate for Palestine. It's the preamble to the mandate. In 7 of the 28 articles of that mandate, there is an effort to substantially amplify and expand on the commitments of the Balfour Declaration. So the mandate is, in effect, an elaboration of the Balfour Declaration. Thus, the British government could hide behind the terms of their League of Nations mandate in denying the Palestinians treatment as an independent nation in accordance with Article 22 of the Covenant of the League of Nations. I would therefore argue that the Palestinians were in a triple bind. This may have been unique in the entire history of the resistance of indigenous peoples to European colonialism. They faced the might of the British Empire in an era between the world wars in which not one single colonial possession, with the partial exception of Ireland, succeeded in freeing itself from the clutches of the European powers. This was not an age of liberation. This was not an age of decolonization. It was an age in which the colonial empires maintained their power. The Palestinians faced as well an international colonizing movement with a national mission and with its own independent sources of finance and support, besides those which were generously offered by Britain. And finally, they were confronted with the international legitimacy that was accorded to British rule by the League of Nations, which had sanctified the Balfour Declaration and its colonial import for the Palestinians by endowing it with the legal imprimatur of the preeminent international body of its day. The Balfour Declaration was thus transmogrified, transformed. It became more than just a statement by the British cabinet. It became an internationally sanctioned legal document. In explaining the failure of the Palestinians to retain control of their ancestral homeland, alongside understanding the shortcomings of their leaders and the hindrances that resulted from fissures within Palestinian society, we must keep in mind the triple bind they were in, facing Britain, Zionism, and international legitimacy. Now, before November 2nd, 1917, the Zionist movement was both a national movement in embryo and a colonial enterprise without a fixed metropole, like an orphan searching for a foster parent. when it found such a parent in Great Britain, as symbolized by the Balfour Declaration, the colonization and transformation of Arab Palestine into a Jewish state could begin in earnest. This process was backed very soon afterwards, as I've suggested, by the international legitimacy provided by the League of Nations mandate. Importantly, however, it was backed as well by an indispensable iron wall of British bayonets, in the words of that most forthright of Zionist leaders, Zev Jabotinsky. It was not just international legitimacy, it was also British bayonets that supported this process. Seen from the perspective of the Palestinian people, the careful, calibrated, diplomatic prose of the Balfour Declaration amounted, as I've suggested, to a declaration of war on them. For the next few decades, this war was waged in several ways. It was waged by the Zionist movement with money, legal means, propaganda, and finally with mortars and car bombs. It was waged by the British Empire with multiple forms of repression, prison camps, exile, summary executions, warplanes, tanks, and artillery. By the end of the Arab Revolt in Palestine in 1939, 10% of the adult male population of Palestine was dead, wounded, imprisoned, or in exile. That is a very heavy weight of British repression employed in service of this project. The issuance of the Balfour Declaration, therefore, I submit, marked the beginning of a century-long colonial conflict in Palestine, supported by an array of outside powers. In much different forms, this conflict continues until this day. Now, I realize that I may have imposed on your patience by summarizing some of the history around the Balfour Declaration and how it affected the Palestinians. Some would say that we should forget history in dealing with the Palestine conflict. I would suggest that those who say something along these lines have an absolutely miserable track record of failure in attempting to resolve the core issues at stake, specifically the conflict between the Palestinian and Israeli peoples. Ignoring history is one of the things that has brought us to where we are in 2017. In fact, I would argue, I'm a historian, so I would do this, but I would nevertheless argue that this historical background is essential to understanding why this conflict has lasted for so long and is essential to understanding how it might be justly resolved. This background also helps us to understand that it did not begin in 1967 or in 1948, as some short-sighted observers would have it. Finally, this background points out the avenue towards a real, lasting, sustainable peace and towards real reconciliation and compromise between the Palestinian and Israeli peoples. Reconciliation, as the South Africans can attest, depends on acknowledging historical realities rather than ignoring them. Genuine compromise must be based on justice and absolutely equal treatment and absolutely equal rights for all. It must not, it cannot be based on the imposition of the will of the stronger on the weaker. That is not compromise. That is something else. I would argue that this historical background points to another fact. And this is something that I can say here in a body that has over 200 members, most of which are not great powers. What I am about to say may offend the great powers, but I'm going to go ahead and say it. I'm not a diplomat. I can say whatever I please. And this fact is the following. It is that peace between Palestine and Israel is far too important to be left to the self-interested ministrations of the great powers alone. Again and again, the history of the League of Nations, the history of the United Nations, show us that these great powers were responsible for imposing formulas in Palestine that suited their interests of the moment. In every single case, these formulas created, exacerbated, and magnified this conflict. In so doing, these great powers have ignored international law, and they have ignored essential elements of the covenants and charters that they themselves helped to shape, such as the principle of self-determination that animates both the covenant of the League of Nations and the Charter of the United Nations. If there's one defining principle behind those two documents, crafted essentially by the great powers of the day themselves, it is the principle of self-determination. It's this principle that has been ignored in one respect in Palestine. As someone who is the son of an international civil servant who faithfully served the United Nations for his entire career, I have been a close witness for many decades to the failures of this body, of the United Nations, to live up to its principles where Palestine is concerned. I was sitting in the Security Council chamber as a visitor when the United Nations Security Council attempted to pass a ceasefire resolution in June 1967. I used to come to this building all the time. There was no security in those days. One could enter very easily. So I have witnessed episode after episode after episode of this failure, which I would ascribe largely to the machinations of the great powers. I am not naive, however. And as a historian, I know all too well that power has its prerogatives. We see that most clearly, of course, in the Security Council. But the United Nations was not set up to make the world a more comfortable place for the powerful, but rather to bring peace with justice and to bring the rule of international law. Over the 100 years since the Balfour Declaration was issued, over the 70 years since the passage of UN General Assembly Resolution 181 in this month in 1947, in the 50 years since the adoption of UN Security Council Resolution 242 in this month, in 1967, neither peace with justice nor the rule of law has prevailed where Palestine is concerned. It is high time for the United Nations and the entire world community to act in this spirit. Specifically, after a full century, it is high time that the establishment of a national home promised by Balfour and the League of Nations to the Jewish people in 1917 and afterwards be matched by the establishment of a national home for the Palestinian people. After 70 full years, it is high time that the national self-determination promised to the Israeli people by the United Nations General Assembly in November 1947, and that the Israeli people have enjoyed since 1948, be enjoyed by the Palestinian people. And after 50 full years, it is high time for the injunction in UN Security Council resolution forbidding, quote, the acquisition of territory by war to be vigorously enforced where the territories occupied in 1967 are concerned. Finally, it is high time for the United Nations and for the entire international community to take vigorous action, belatedly, to break the century-old logjam created and perpetuated by the great powers. This man-made logjam has prevented the principle of self-determination from being applied fairly and equally to both parties of this conflict, the Palestinian and Israeli peoples. They both deserve the peace and stability that only an equitable resolution of the conflict between them on the basis of international law and in a spirit of justice and equality would bring. Thank you very much.
You have been listening to Palestinian historian Rashi Khalidi speaking at the UN on the impact of the Balfour Declaration on the Palestinian people. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.